This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place, whether you're in the mood for a seductive evening of opera, interactive exhibits that play with color, light, and sound, or a stage drama with a big dose of laughter. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. A wild and fiery gypsy seductress, Bizet's Carmen wields her independent spirit, opening the season for the New Orleans Opera. Mezzo-soprano Jennifer Johnson Cano sings the title role. She joins us with stage director Keturah Stickan. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Passion, jealousy, and revenge dominate this French opera, which was quite shocking for audiences in Paris when it premiered back in the day in the late 1800s. Why was this work so controversial back then?
This is Keturah. I think ultimately it was showing things on stage that had not been shown on stage before. It was showing a type of person, a community, a group of people. It was showing a strong woman who stood up for herself and had a strength and a voice that I think people at the time weren't used to seeing.
Now, the work is in a genre classified as opera comique, but it's not a comedy. What exactly does that classification mean?
Opera comique, I think, had a bit of an operetta idea to it. There's dialogue. I also will say that there is quite a bit of comedy in Carmen. We don't think of it that way because we know the tragic ending, but when you go through the whole piece and you really look at the way that it's structured, there is a comic element that winds its way through it in order to offset some of the more tragic elements.
So let's talk about the storyline. Who is Carmen and where is the opera set?
The opera is set in Seville between 1820 and 1830. Carmen is a Roma woman who is working in a tobacco factory in Seville. She falls in love with a young soldier there who is not quite what she expected when she first meets him.
And this is José?
This is José. She's hoping that they will be able to have a relationship going forward, but as soon as his massive jealousy sort of comes out in relation to the work that she has to do for her community, she becomes tired of him and realizes that he is not a person that she can maintain any sort of relationship with. And so she falls, as we do, falls out of love with him and begins a relationship with a torero, a matador, that is performing at the Bull Arena. And at that time, José's jealousy goes off the rails and Carmen meets her demise because she doesn't let down to him. She doesn't give in to him. She stands up for herself and he won't listen to it. And takes her down.
She's an independent woman.
I feel like she's one of the strongest female characters in opera.
Now, Jennifer, have you sung the title role before?
I have. This will be my third production of Carmen. And tagging on to this idea of her being this strong, independent woman, I would venture to say she's one of the most fascinatingly complex, yet very simple, and at all times an incredibly human character. She has her flaws, she has her isms, but she's also remarkably likable and relatable, which is why I think ultimately the opera has had this sort of massive endearment to the community for all these years.
What do you find most challenging in this performance?
I think a lot of people think they know Carmen. They think they know what the character should be. They hear Spanish, gypsy, fiery. And the truth is, in my estimation, when you're really looking at the score and really looking at what she says, that's putting her into a box that doesn't quite fit who she is. So the biggest challenge is actually overcoming what people think they should expect from the piece. And I'm just going to leave that there.
And Keturah, where did your imagination take you in bringing this work to the stage?
I always start with primary source. So I read the novella a long time ago when I was first working on Carmen. I always feel like if I'm going to do a traditional production or a period piece, I want to take from the original tale. What we see in the original tale is that it's told from an unreliable narrator. It's told from Don José's point of view. And the big thing that I wanted to do in bringing out this character and in telling this story was making sure that Carmen got her voice moving into this, because so much of the stereotype that we see with Carmen comes from this idea that Bizet and Mérimée, in writing the novella in the first place, they were looking at gypsy culture and the women in this culture as having a very specific and not particularly substantiated idea about who they were, that they were loose, that they were manipulative, that they were seductresses in a very sort of witch-like way, that they were able to sort of cast spells and bring these men into the fold. And really, that's not the case. And so I wanted to be able to tell Carmen's story authentically and really allow her to be a fully formed human with fully formed emotions and not just a stereotypical sorceress that turns Don José into this jealous madman, which is not the case. Carmen does not need, especially in this day and age when psychology is now part of her experience, Carmen certainly doesn't need to be from the Romani culture. She doesn't need to be that at all. She could be any woman who falls in love with a man who falls in love with her, anybody that has that immediate chemistry with each other. I think that that's what I wanted to make sure, is that we see a fully formed, well-rounded human being when we experience Carmen on the stage.
What are you hoping modern audiences will take away from this performance?
You take away from art what you bring to it, your own life experience and your own interpretation. And the greatest gift that we as performers, as creators, I think can have is that you leave and you have a conversation with people the next day about what you experienced and, you know, any insight you gained about being a human being.
There are characters up there that will resonate with everybody in the audience. And so I always hope that people will come and see a little of themselves, feel a little of themselves, learn a little about themselves by experiencing somebody else's story up on the stage.
Mezzo-soprano Jennifer Johnson-Cano and director Keturah Stikhan, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The New Orleans Opera opens its season with Bizet's Carmen. Performances run Friday, October 4th, and Sunday, October 6th, at the Mahalia Jackson Theater. More info is online at neworleansopera.org. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. The multifaceted career of pioneering artist Christopher Janney comes alive, transforming sound, sparkling colors, light, and technology in unique ways. The artist, musician, and architect has been altering spaces with his unusual style for decades. He has two projects underway that might make you consider a road trip to the capital city. One is an interactive exhibit at the Louisiana Art and Science Museum in Baton Rouge called Sound is an Invisible Color. The other is a 4,000-square-foot entrance to the new Our Lady of the Lake Children's Hospital, called Harmonic Grove, that invites those young and young at heart to play. We caught up with Christopher Janney by phone in Boston. Chris, welcome to Inside the Arts.
Nice to be in New Orleans virtually.
Virtually, yes. Tell me, in what ways are you exploring light, sound, and color in this exhibit, Sound is an Invisible Color?
My training is as an architect and a jazz musician, so I'm forever trying to combine those two disciplines. Sometimes I try to make architecture more like music, and it comes out in a series I call the Urban Musical Instruments, of which Harmonic Grove, which is the latest piece at Our Lady of the Lake Children's Hospital, is a good example. And then on the other side, trying to make music more like architecture, more physical, more visual. I did a piece 2 years back with Mikhail Baryshnikov where he danced to the sound of his own heartbeat in real time, and then I scored a string quartet to play over top that. So that's a pretty good example of trying to make music physical.
So let's talk about the first exhibit, Sound is an Invisible Color. Exactly what does the title refer to? Most of us don't think of sound as a color.
I sort of think it's the artist's job to push the boundary, right? There's actually four pieces in the exhibition that explore that idea in different ways. You know, I do a lot of work with transparent colored glass, which is a good example in the Harmonic Grove piece. There's a 4,000-square-foot colored glass canopy. But in my studio, since I can't keep making things that big all the time, I do a lot of smaller maquette studies in transparent glass or transparent colored resin. And the Sound is an Invisible Color series is really a series of wall sculptures that have these big colored forms, but then in the middle of each one, there's a little place that says touch. And you touch that and it triggers a sound composition that is also embedded within the piece. I did a piece at this museum in 1981, a piece that was my thesis at MIT called Sound Stair. It was a musical instrument that I designed that could interface with any existing stairway. And I toured it all over the world. I did the Metropolitan Museum of Art stairs in New York. I did the Spanish Steps in Rome. But also on that first tour in 1981, the Louisiana Arts and Science Museum invited me to put it on their interior stairway. So I brought that back. And that is on the stairway as you approach my Sound is an Invisible Color exhibit. So before you even get to the exhibit, you sort of have a little experience of this transformed stairway.
How will visitors interact with it?
It's a series of photoelectric sensors, just electric eyes, you know, like when you walk into the supermarket and the door opens automatically.
Mm-hmm.
You're crossing a beam of light. And so I have one beam of light on each of the steps. So as you walk up, you're triggering beams of light, and that's sending that information to a small computer and a sound sampler. So you'll walk up. Sometimes it'll be like the sound of walking through a series of flutes or marimbas or percussion instruments, also mixed with environmental sounds, crickets and frogs and birds. And the nice thing is that there's an ever-changing series of sound banks. So you might walk up and hear one group of sounds that creates a certain kind of image. And then as you walk down, it would be entirely different.
Your second project is called Harmonic Grove. And this is an entranceway to the new Our Lady of the Lake Children's Hospital. Can you tell us how you transform the entrance into an interactive play spot?
Harmonic Grove is the latest of what I call my urban musical instrument. And, you know, there were certain architectural conditions I had to satisfy. There had to be some sort of roof so that it keeps the rain out. And it's also large enough so that cars and ambulances can drive underneath it. But beyond that, really, the idea was to create a place that is soothing and relaxing and also has an element of creative play. I deal with what I call the psychology of architecture. I focus very much on how architecture affects your mood, affects your perception, and in this case, hopefully puts you in a relaxed frame of mind before you're walking into a rather intense environment. So there's actually a series of speakers up in the canopy that are playing environmental sounds that I've recorded from the Bluebonnet Swamp and other bayous, really just to give you a sense of being in a very warm, natural environment. And of course, with the transparent colored glass canopy that are in deep blues and deep greens, you feel very much bathed within this deep color while you hear the sounds of walking in the forest. And then as you look around and you see on the columns that are holding up the canopy, this handprint, usually that's enough, especially with children, to engage their imagination to go over and touch it. And that's when it begins the interactive element.
Now, I hear that the secret to your success has something to do with you doing exactly what you were advised not to do. Can you explain?
Well, so when I was in college studying architecture, I was studying actually with Michael Graves, the architect, and he told me on more than one occasion that I would have to choose between architecture and music because there weren't enough hours in a day to do both. And, you know, this was the late 60s, a time of great experimentation. I'm definitely a child of the 60s, and so I don't think it was so much conscious as it was just my passion to not choose, but in fact put one foot in architecture, one foot in music, and forge a new path.
And you certainly did. What do you hope audiences will take away from this unique experience?
So I think that, you know, this kind of work that tries to sort of walk between two senses and two disciplines hopefully opens everyone's eyes to new possibilities.
Artist, musician, and architect Christopher Janney, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks, Diane. I hope to meet you someday.
Me too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Christopher Janney's exhibit, Sound is an Invisible Color, is on view at the Louisiana Art and Science Museum in Baton Rouge through March 1st, 2020. Our Lady of the Lake Children's Hospital will have a grand opening on Friday, October 4th, in Baton Rouge. You can interact with the new Harmonic Grove entrance and meet Christopher Janney. More info on the artist is online at janneysound.com. Laughter will fill the air as Le Petit Theatre opens its season with Noises Off. The award-winning British farce written by Michael Frayn is a play within a play that quickly gained acclaim on both sides of the pond. Joining me is Artistic Director Max Williams and actress Leslie Castay. Welcome back.
Hi.
Thank you, Diane. So nice to be here.
You truly intend to bring down the house with this comical production. Let's start with the title, Noises Off. What is that in reference to?
You know, in the theater, we have many little sayings, and noises off would be when something's going on in the wings, offstage, that's either a cue or, in this play, maybe a crashing of something or somebody getting beaten up or
an
like
argument.
That.
Yes.
An argument, exactly. So that refers to sounds that are happening sort of offstage while the action is going on stage. This play is about a company of actors who are putting on a play within a play, a farce called Nothing On. So that's also a sort of a play off the title. The play within a play is sort of what we would expect from a standard British sex farce, I guess. Mm-hmm. It also has elements of, you know, spookiness and ghosts and takes place in a country cottage. The character that Leslie is playing, Dottie Ottley, she has spent 13 or 14 seasons on a BBC series where she's played a very beloved character. That run has sort of come to an end, and so she's chosen to mount this play, Nothing On, as her return to the legitimate stage, maybe?
Yes.
Yeah. And
a triumphant return.
Her
as
triumphant.
The Cockney maid.
Exactly. Fortunately for the audience, unfortunately for Dottie, everything does not go according to plan.
Now, what attracted you to this work for your season opener?
You know, Noises Off is a play that has been being performed now for over 3 decades. And one of the, I think, maybe intimidating things about it is it has this reputation of being potentially the funniest play that's ever been written. That's a weird thing when you like approach that, right? When you're like, oh, we're doing what's supposed to be the funniest. Hope it goes over. It's a glimpse into the sort of backstage foibles of this theater company. So it feels very close to the heart at the same time. We just wanted to start with something that was going to be so fun. In the theater, we do a lot of work that we hope has different types of impact, right? Maybe social impact. Maybe it's raising questions about the human condition. And even though this play does kind of nod at that a little bit, in the end, it's just about having a good laugh.
And isn't that cathartic? I mean,
yeah.
It is such a release to go and just see someone crash into a staircase is funny. And to slam their head into a door accidentally is unfortunately funny.
You know, and so really that was the impulse more than anything else is just there's so much going on right now that it's like, let's get away from all of that and let's just have a great time.
If you enjoy going to the theater, I think from both people who maybe will act or perform on stage and as well as those who just sit in the audience, you sit in the audience, you always wonder what's going on off stage. You always wonder, you know, who's having an affair with whom in this cast and who hates whom, who likes whom, what's going on with the old guy and why does he always look drunk on stage? You know, you always have these questions. Well, this play sort of explains what's going on off stage. So it sort of like gives you a little peek of the intrigue and the mystery of that happens, you know, behind those doors. The set.
So tell us more about your character. You play Dottie, a housekeeper, and you do this with a Cockney accent?
For some reason, beloved Dottie Ottley, the television star, I would say, decides to produce this tour, this sort of regional tour through England, playing in second-class tiny little towns.
They all have hyphens in the name.
Yes,
you know,
Stockton-on-Tees.
And Weston Supermare.
Yeah. Even the names of the towns are funny. She picks this play, this farce, and she plays that beloved sort of stock character of the housekeeper that is sort of addled and doesn't really know what's going on in the house and all these doors are slamming behind her and all she really wants to do is kick her feet back up with a plate of sardines and watch like a royal celebration on the television and, you know, everything happens around her and hilarity ensues. Sardines play a very, very important role in this play, by the way.
A plate of sardines.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that you can share from the production?
Sure. This is from the opening scene. Act one takes place on the final dress rehearsal before the opening night of the tour. Maxwell will read the character of Lloyd, the director of the play, and Dottie is trying to rehearse the first scene, and she can't quite remember what to do with that plate of sardines, nor can she quite remember the lines. And so it's all very approximate. She plays the role of Mrs. Clackett, the Cockney housekeeper.
Soon as you take the weight off your feet, down it all comes on your head. And I take the sardines. No, I leave the sardines. No, I take the sardines.
You leave the sardines and you put the receiver back.
Oh, yes. I put the receiver back.
And you leave the sardines.
I leave the sardines?
You leave the sardines.
I put the receiver back and I leave the sardines.
Right.
We've changed that, have we, love?
No, love.
Oh, that's what I've always been doing.
I shouldn't say that, Dottie, my precious.
Oh, how about the words, love? Am I getting some of them right?
Some of them have a very familiar ring.
Oh, it's like a slot machine in there.
I know that, Dottie.
I open my mouth and I don't know if it's going to come out. Three oranges or two lemons and a banana.
Anyway, it's not midnight yet. We don't open till tomorrow, so you're holding the receiver.
I'm holding the receiver.
Squire, Squire Ackerman, hold on.
Squire, Squire Ackerman, hold on. Don't go away. I'm putting it down. Always the same, isn't it? Put your feet up for 2 minutes and immediately they come running after you. She's already improvising.
Absolutely. Trying to figure out what to do during this tech rehearsal that's stretching on towards midnight with their first audience the next night. I want to go on record as saying I am not playing Lloyd in the play. Lloyd is played by the masterful Ian Hoke. He just couldn't be with us today.
He's wonderful.
So, I hope I didn't do too much disregard to the character in my temper.
You're forgiven. You're
it.
Forgiven. It's art imitating life.
Right.
Can you tell us about the set for this production?
So Noises Off is structured in three acts, although we'll just be taking the one intermission. The first act takes place in the living room of the Brents' country cottage. It's a two-story set. And then the second act, you see everything that happened in the first act, essentially, but you see what's going on backstage. And then the third act, the set turns around again, and you see them at the end of their run when everything is just sort of completely disintegrated, right? So this set is, I must say, quite impressive. It's two stories tall. It's on a giant turntable that's motorized. So right there in front of the audience, it starts to spin around. It's pretty incredible.
Will audiences view theater differently after this experience?
Well, maybe they'll appreciate that it's harder than it looks, you know?
Actress Leslie Castay and artistic director Max Williams. Thanks for the laughs.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Michael Frayn's award-winning British comedy, Noises Off, opens at Liberty Theatre Friday, October 4th. Performances run through October 20th. More info is online at libertytheatre.com. That's our show for this week. Major support for Inside the Arts comes from the Helles Foundation. Additional support comes from Le Petit Theatre. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45 when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.